everybody. Welcome to Crew Call with Mike Rose, Volume 1, Number 2. We're starting the very first Crew Call ever recorded before noontime, which is a big deal for me. And I'm here chatting with my good old friend, Mike Confalone, a man who should need no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. Mike and I go way back, and he's probably known to people from his magazine, Railroad Explorer, that he published back in 2000 until recently. He's done all kinds of articles for Model Railroad Hobbyist, and as of late has become known for his videos, including videos of my own layout. So enough about that. Welcome to the call, Mike.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
I thought that it might be interesting to have a member of the layout ops crew on right after an ops session, because less than a week ago you were down here with a small subset of the usual suspects, and it was the first ops session that that we did after the giant, you know, carve up the layout and move part of it out into the new addition, and then reconnect all the dots. You know, I wanted some of the experienced guys here, because I thought it was going to work okay. The layout had tested scarily well, but, you know, until you get the thing in operation with people other than yourself, you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's a little different for you, because you've probably hosted more obsessions than anybody I know personally.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing it here since I think the first Allagash obsession was 2010. So the Allagash was born in the summer of 2009. The concept tore down the rest of the existing railroad, or modified a lot of sections of it to accommodate the new proposed Allagash. And I think our first session was 2010. So about a year after that. And since that time, so you figure 9 years, that's pretty scary. Wow.
Well, but yeah, you know, in preparation for this, not that I ever need preparation for a call from you, my wife always kids me that, you know, if we're not good 3 hours on the phone a week, we're not doing it right.
Right.
But,
right.
But, I found an email going back to, 2007. And right before it was actually, we were trying to arrange a visit up to your place, and then apparently you had come down to my place and done what we came to call confaloning of the of some track.
It was the old scrapyard there, right?
Yeah. So it was interesting to kind of read about some of the feedback we were getting, and I think, you know, one of the fun things has been how over all the years, the interaction we've had with each other's layouts has just kind of mushroomed, you know?
Well, we're both doing, you know, we've both been working on relatively ambitious projects over the years. And, you know, that lends itself to all kinds of different adventures, if you would say. So I would say, you know, you need to purge. You have an email from me from 2007. You need to purge. What are you doing?
You just never know when you're going to need something from way back. It does go way back. I was thinking that, you know, when I go up to your place, it's kind of cool to see some of my old buildings up there, I don't know if you have the same reaction when you come down here and you see some of your stuff here. You know, it's kind of
well,
fun.
I've had, yeah, that. I mean, I've had a lot of there's a lot of my footprints are all over that railroad, and yours are here too. So
right.
When I go down, like, you know, this past weekend, I noticed some things that I had worked on, or maybe some areas we brainstormed and stuff. There's always that. And when you know, same goes here on the Allagash. There's lots of Mike Rose.
Yeah, it's just kind of grown over time. You know, I was picturing the other day that image of me on my hands and knees on top of what is now the Oxford County. You know.
That was perhaps the most ambitious. That was a threaded rod one.
Yeah, that was a long day, boy.
That was a brutal, brutal effort. So
I think I probably left there after 10 o'clock or something like that.
Yeah, that was long. That was way too long. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that make a good railroad great. Those kinds of outside the box adventures, and you know, we've done a lot of that on yours. So a lot of scenery planning, and you know, which has led to a lot of reconstruction. Now, just circling back to the operating frequency, you know, I don't think I've ever taken a break. I know I took a break back in 2017 because of some personal stuff going on, but it wasn't that long. It was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 or 6 months. But since 2010, so, you know, 9 years, we've operated consistently on probably an average interval of, say 6 weeks. And that's, you know, and it gone between, say, 4 and 7 weeks. Yours, in this particular case, I think it was, what, 10 months?
It was 10 months. And I think prior to that, I had been in a kind of a modern role of maybe not every 6 weeks, but I probably did, I don't know, maybe four in the year before that, which was, you know, a lot for me, particularly where we're also going other layouts and, you know, your house a lot. I actually, you know, I credit operating at your place with showing me how to do an op session and how to operate and learning how a layout should run and also how to incrementally tweak things and improve and learn from every op session. But I think beyond that, I also learned from you the no sacred cows approach.
No sacred cows.
Yeah, no, I think you showed me to not be afraid to take something and, in your case, throw it in the driveway, or in my case, throw it in the dumpster, and then just get right in there and build it back up again. And your fast construction methods are what enabled me to actually consider that. You know what I mean? Mm. Like the foam stuff was a revelation, and you know, the grout parking lots. I mean, I don't think I ever would have thought of using grout for these dirt parking lots as you've done so effectively. But man, the proof was in Tunkhannock. You know what I mean? Like, wouldn't have looked right without that. You know, so there's a lot of little things I picked up from you that I don't know if I would have come up with on my own, because a lot of your stuff is very original. You know.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's original, but there's a lot, you know, I've taken from people, you know, for instance, the ground up leaves thing, which I have everywhere on the railroad. Now, I have to have that in my season. It's, you know, that's what you see in the forest, you know. Now, I didn't invent that. That was Lou Sassy.
Oh,
and I don't know if Lou invented it, but that's where I learned it from one of his scenery videos probably 30 years ago.
For all we know, he could have learned it from Dave Freire or somebody.
Who knows?
Like that,
yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly. So that's where it came from as far as I'm concerned. And then I've developed my own techniques to support some of the other techniques that I learned from some of the more seasoned modelers over the years. So it's an evolutionary process where you take from those that have learned before you, and you maybe modify the techniques a little, and then you add your own stuff to it. And before you know it, you've got your own sort of game plan. Like, I can do any scene. I could, you know, if I work on the Martin Spur tomorrow, I know what I need to do. You know, I don't have to recreate the wheel. I kind of have a game plan to get through the scenery, and there's a list of ingredients and a list of steps, et cetera. So, you know, it's a learning process. You learn from the best thing to do is to keep your mind open to some ideas that are, you know, not necessarily inside the traditional box, because if you get boxed in, then things tend to look like everybody else's railroad. You want to try and break out if you can.
Well, things change, materials change, techniques change. How long do you think you've been built, you know, when did you like start model railroading in terms of building a railroad, a model railroad itself?
Well, the first, my first model railroad was, I think it was 11. I got it for Christmas, train set. So 1978.
It's interesting you should choose that age, because it's the same age for me. You know, maybe that's the age when you can actually, you know, start using your hands to do something constructive.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I was interested in trains before then, of course, but that was my first formal model railroad. And then my dad built, you know, it was on a 4x8. I think it was actually on a 4x7 piece of masonite, of all things. Now, I don't
masonite.
Know how. Yeah, masonite. Can you believe that?
No.
Probably had it laying around in the basement, and that was it. And then I asked him to extend it, and he put a hinge on and made the thing another foot wide. It was ridiculous, because I couldn't. You can't. you know, nail anything down.
It's right. I don't think I heard this before. This is fascinating.
It was not. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
What was it on, like a couple of sawhorses or something?
Yeah, I think it was actually. And it would stay, the railroad stayed up. It was in my bedroom. And it was just a, you know, an oval with a few sidings. And that's where I started experimenting with scenery and woodland scenic stuff. And was a member of the local model railroad club through the local hobby shop and really just caught on fire. And I think that railroad stayed, if I'm correct, it was in the bedroom until, so that would have been 78, 79-ish, till 1984. That's when I met my wife, Susan. So, well, she was my wife at the time, obviously. We were high school sweethearts, and we still are, you know, 30 years later, 30 years of marriage. Nice. I think the railroad came down when I met her, or, you know, around that time, because it was just, I was going away to college. I think it was up. She saw it for sure and knew what she was in for, big time. So, but I think it came down just before going away to school in early 85.
It's very common that people take a hiatus during those times, you know, the going away to school and right. You know, picking a career and kind of starting your adult life. And then you tend to revisit it when things sort of get under control as much as they ever do.
I did a little bit of modeling in college. There was a hobby shop in Scranton. I went to the University of Scranton. There was a hobby shop there. I'd get some detailed parts, and I was working on, I remember working on like model power RS-11s and things, because I was a big D&H fan at the time, because the D&H was there in Taylor in Scranton. So I'd do, you know, modeling projects on the kitchen table of my apartment, but it was limited, you know. And it wasn't until the first, so after that first model railroad came down, it wasn't until 1995, actually, that I built my next model railroad. My dad and I built it in the basement of our old house. Oh, wow. And that was a Vermont-based, another freelance kind of thing. And based in the fall, it was, you know, it was a good, I don't know, it was a good little railroad for a period of time. I had some nice little, we didn't have operating sessions. I wasn't part of a group at that time. So it was more just screwing around, you know, playing around and having fun with trains, getting back into it a little bit. And really, there was not until we moved into this house in 99, really the early 2000s is when I started to get back into modeling and started.
You don't have any pictures of that old layout, do you?
I have some prints from the old house. What I was more interested in making smoke units for my roundhouse RS3s.
And that's, you know, what happens when you watch Alcos, right?
That's all we did is, you know, exactly. I was an Alco fanatic. So I said, I'm going to figure out a way to do this. And I built these gigantic exhaust stacks out of brass and put them on the I didn't care if the thing, what it sounded like or ran like, as long as it made smoke. And I had these constant smoke units in there, and they just would fill a room. It was crazy.
Couldn't have been good for you.
Probably not. But I have some prints of that, some prints laying around I can show you. And
I'd love to see those.
It was crazy. Yeah, that was. I still have a couple of those RS3s.
I don't have anything from that era, but the only thing I do have were some fairly crude model shots that our buddy Dave took for me that ended up in Railroad Modeler when I was 16 years old. Wow. And that was like the first article I ever had published. We took the pictures of this thing like on a board outside.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Nice natural light.
Oh my God. It,
excellent.
It couldn't have been more crude.
Well, but that's where you get started and you look back. I wish I wasn't such a purger, because I wish I had kept everything from that era, from those eras. I have paperwork upstairs. I kept all this stuff because I've always been a proto freelancer. I've never been a prototype modeler. Although basically what I do is prototype modeling, but there's a creative side of me that will not be squelched, and I need to create my own railroad. And I've done that since I was very young.
None of it ever feels hokey. You know what I mean?
Like
it's all defensible.
Well, I used to, I've got some typewritten pages from, this is probably in my college years, I guess, where I actually had, this is an old railroad called the St. Johnsbury and Wells River, which was a Vermont-based
Don't you still have one of those engines around?
Yeah, that's one of the smoking RS3s.
Okay.
I've got a couple of C424s too, Atlas units that are still on the shelf there, and I'll never get rid of those. But I used to type up, you know, all kinds of operating plans and just, you know, nonsense. But it was fun. It was creative fun, and I kept all that stuff. But I wish I'd kept the models because, geez, we had some, you know, by today's standards, they would be just absolute junk. I mean, not even worthy of the space on a shelf, but they'd be cool because they would kind of show you, well, it's a time capsule, right? And
well, it's interesting that you mentioned the operating plans because it seems like that's part of your core and origin in the model railroading interest. And it's, and for me, it's something that I really had to learn. It feels like I never really had a clue about that. I always had an idea of how I wanted things to look and how I wanted to build them and all of that. But really, and that's why, of course, I had to tear my entire layout apart and rebuild it a couple of times. Because, you know, I built something that I ended up with and just thought, yeah, that's not it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I think, and that's sort of the reason, the main reason why I trashed the old Woodsville Terminal, which was the original short line that would sort of got some attention back in 2006 and 7.
That's the first completed stuff that you did that I saw personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when I went up there, that was largely what was done, right? Not much else.
Yeah. That was it. And now the rest of the basement was going to connect, the rest of the railroad was going to connect to that and make a, you know, it was a prototype. That was the freelance portion of what was essentially a prototype scenario. But, you know, you look at what you have created there and say, is this really going to satisfy my needs for, you know, what I'm trying to get out of the hobby? And that is where it became very evident to me that I simply wasn't interested enough in this podunk short line. It was cool, but I needed more. And at that point, I started to think back to some of the guys who had done some of these real memorable proto freelance railroads like Custer, Tony with his Allegheny Midland, and Alan McClellan with the V&O, and to some extent Jack Ozanich with the Atlantic Great Eastern. And I said to myself, I want something bigger. I think I could really, I have enough knowledge about, it's getting back to your point about operations, about prototype railroading in this region, in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and northern New England. I had a deep knowledge of it because I've been
based on rail fanning.
Based on rail fanning and since I was a kid reading articles in Trains magazine and really fully understanding it and visiting it and spending a lot of years rail fanning. So then you have that base knowledge. It's easier to create something from scratch that doesn't smell like a rat. You know, it's got to be right. And if you don't have that base knowledge of real railroading, now, I'm not saying I'm a railroader. I don't know every rule in the rule book. I don't concern myself with that so much.
No, but you know what it should look like. You know how it should run and how it should operate and interact. And
like
your interest in, you know, the manifest kind of method of operation. You were always interested in where did it come from, where is it going, why is it doing that. You know what I mean? And that's a fundamental element of realistic operation.
Yeah, there were some people that, and I won't mention any names, but some guys, some friends of mine that have helped with understanding traffic, understanding waybills and freight cars, you know, things like that. And those helped to lend a more of a prototypical flavor to things. But the overall broad operation, you know, if you say, well, I'd like to create a freelance railroad, I want it to be in the state of Maine, because of the industry there and because of the other railroads are there, you have to have that knowledge. Otherwise, if you create this, where's it going to start, go from and to? Who's it going to interchange with? Why would it interchange? Et cetera, et cetera. Changing to the Allegash or creating the Allegash in 2009 was sort of the birth of like a major research project. And how do I make this thing seem real? Because there's a lot of, you know, people, they look at it and say, well, it seems like a real railroad. And the point is, I guess, you have to almost get into the mindset that it is real. Otherwise, you tend to do things that are a little bit on the hokey side. Yeah.
So when I went up to your house the first time and I saw the Woodsville Terminal, the Allegash wasn't conceived of at that time?
No, the Allegash was not conceived.
I realized that.
Yeah. So I was down in North Carolina, where my wife is right now visiting her parents. We were down there. We used to go annually, and we went that particular year. We went a second time. We typically go in April for spring break when Tom was out of school, and we for some reason we went in August. We were out on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and I don't know if I had been. It must have been thinking about this. It must have been biting at me and itching me for a while, because I just remember that I called a good friend of mine, you know, Joe Posick, and gave him the news that I'm pulling the plug on this other thing. I'm going with this proto freelance thing. I've got this idea. And I had done some base. I brought maps with me, and on my downtime, I was looking at the maps and sort of plotting where this railroad could go. And it just took on a life of its own very quickly, very quickly, very quickly. And I knew that the concept was sound. For whatever reason, it just felt right. And I said, yeah, I think this is going to work. I think this is going to happen. And I started to...
Sounds like the product of many, many hours of just thinking it through.
Well, yeah, that was just the start of the mental anguish I started to go through with this, because once you take that step and you say, well, I'm going to do this, then it becomes like, wow. Okay, now I got to really think this out. I got to look at the map. I got to figure things out. I got to look at who the connections are at that time. What were the economic conditions at that time? What would be a plausible roster? What kind of freight cars? What kind of customers? What do I want? What would be likely to be there? How do I make this railroad, the Allegash, look different than the Maine Central? The Maine Central is the railroad in Maine. It's very sure. hard to, or the
you
Bangor
want to do another Maine Central.
Or another Bangor and a Roostick, or, you know, so I needed to take elements from both of those, because they were both great railroads and I loved them both, and somehow work that into my plan, but make it look different at the same time. So it was a little bit of nuance there. And I think I've got it pretty close. I mean, there's some obvious copying going on, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's egregious. There's enough of the uniqueness with the AGR roster and with anything else. Hang on one sec here. Just answering a text from my wife.
In the middle of a podcast.
Gotta do it, man. Family first, Mike. Family first. So
it's interesting that your origins based on your rail fanning. I mean, I would say it's the same thing on my end that it was, you know, I've rail fanned all over the place and pretty much enjoyed everywhere I've ever gone. You know, in other words, mm-hmm. every place has had a great deal of merit, but I kept coming back to Pennsylvania. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was something about the concentration of railroading and in mm-hmm. particular, the interactions between big railroads and short lines there that just really appealed to me.
Yes.
And I guess to tie it back to the op session, I mean, that was kind of what was driving the addition that I put up and the expansion of the layout into it. And I was just interested in your impressions of whether or not you could see how moving forward, these interactions with not just, you know, Conrail being the railroad, but some of the D&H stuff, the Pocono Northeast. I mean, you switched to the TMSL yourself. What were your thoughts about how that has influenced how much you enjoy operating here or not?
Wow, that's a long question. So what
25 words or less. No.
generally speaking, I would say... generally speaking, I think as modelers, we want to have our cake and eat it too. And I think that's, are you there, Mike? You
still? Oh,
there?
Yeah.
I think that's a natural, it's difficult to.
I based my whole life on that.
Yeah, right. So it's difficult to just, to be disciplined and say, you know what, I'm just going to do this and end of story and blah, 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 blah. I've gone to great lengths to find ways to make my operation more interesting. And I've created this new short line, the Oxford County, blah, blah, blah. I've done a lot of things to really push the envelope. And in your case, I think you're doing the same, but you have prototype examples that are there or were there that
it's like the more I learn about my prototype, the more of it I wanted to incorporate
because it's so cool. Yeah, and I think you know, having more D&H presence and having the short line presence, it makes it more interesting because yes, Conrail's a great railroad. Everybody, I'd love to see Conrail again. I kick myself for the many times back in the day when I ignored Conrail and said, it's just Conrail, blah, blah, just go, you know, the hell with it and go, oops, I said a bad word. Sorry. But you know,
seems like it will always be there. So why pay attention?
Why bother? But now you look at it and say, oh, wouldn't we all love to have Big Blue back?
Right.
So I guess my point is this, Conrail is a great railroad. And it's very interesting, a lot of interesting operations, and you captured a lot of that. But at the end of the day, that can only satisfy so much. And then you start to say, you know what, I'd really like to have a short line here. How can I work that in? Oh, there happens to be a couple of them. So let's expand the map, you know, do the extension. And by doing so, we're not just adding more Conrail, we're adding D&H, we're adding the Pocono Northeast, the TMS, you know, all these things make the overall operation more interesting. When I was at the session last weekend, I ran the TMSL job, which I had never done before. So I was up by myself in the old building in the scenic portion. And
it's true. Everybody was sort of clustered around the other side of the place. So you were really by yourself, like you went somewhere and did something.
Yes, by myself. And I enjoyed that very much. It was serene over there, nice and peaceful. And occasionally I'd hear the rumble of a train coming under the hidden track or, you know, whatever. So, but it was nice to do that. And then I also ran the, I don't remember the symbol.
WASY 10.
10, yeah,
out of
10.
Sayre. Yeah.
I ran that, which connected or interchanged with the short line. So I was able to run the Conrail side of that and experience that. You know, so that variety is the spice of life. So it's one of those things where as a person who's modeling, if you're a person that's going to be creating a large model railroad, you better prepare for variety because things will get old.
Well, no, remember I talked about that year when I had probably the most op sessions that I ran, maybe that year I did four.
Okay.
And it occurred to me at that time that for me, and maybe not necessarily for the participants, I really don't know, but it was starting to look like a lather, rinse, repeat kind of situation because the whole layout at that time was just a single track main line from staging to staging with a few locals and road freights. And I just had this feeling of there may not be a lot of variety in these op sessions moving forward. I mean, there'd be minor variety, of course, because, you know, you're not going to switch every industry every time. But right. I was looking for a way to get more options because I like op sessions to have some of the same elements every time, but also people can do different things.
Yeah, and options. Yep.
And I think once everything, you know, once the full vision here gets realized, you know, I think you're already running a two stage op session basically, where you do some of it in one, and then you do the rest of it or something else, you know, in the next one. And I really liked the idea of that because when they're spaced far enough apart, by the time you're doing something that you did the first time, a lot of chronological time has passed and then it doesn't feel at all stale, you know? And I think it's possible that I might end up doing a three stage op session here. I can kind of conceive that there's enough options to perhaps try doing that, you know?
I would say, well, in my case, there's a couple of different ways of looking at that. So for the Allagash, the reason I went to splitting the schedule and doing a half session is because a couple of reasons. Number one, things were just too hectic. I mean, you know, Madrid Yard, Joe Posick was the guy who was running that most times, or Dave, you know, and Dave's been there. Santos has been there quite a bit lately. Bottom line is that yard's nuts. Just crazy. And to get through all of the trains that we had scheduled in a typical, say, 6 or 7 hours of running was the pace was too much.
Right.
It was not realistic. Not just, you know, it's becoming, I can see the stress.
Sure.
And not that the guys were stressed out, but Madrid was stressed and Joe was, you know, it was too busy. And I said,
to his credit, no matter what happened, he handled it.
Oh, no, absolutely. Because he's really good at that. But
to the point where you said, I think, that you wouldn't want to do it.
I would crawl in a corner and cry like a baby if I had to do the Madrid yard. No way. I'm not a yard guy, but my own, I mean, I understand the yard. I've designed it. I understand what's there. I could run it. I wouldn't want to run it. But having said all that, it just wasn't realistic because I'm modeling a railroad based in Maine in the mid 80s. It's not like, you know, some major.
It's not like the middle division.
No, it's just not, nor should it look anything like that. So the real reason for splitting the schedule is to slow things down. Remember, I talked to everybody, and I think I need to remind some people about this. the objective is not to get your job done, because that's just not the way it goes.
The objective is to enjoy the process.
Yes. And also
didn't I can at Carthage in the last session?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's a good thing. But slow down, you know, take the 10-second break to tie on, to uncouple, whatever, and work those little breaks in so that everybody just exhales a little bit and enjoys it more.
Right.
So by stretching,
I like the modern pace a lot.
No, I love it.
It's a lot more relaxing.
It is. It's a lot.
We also used to op till we dropped. I mean, the sessions were just too long. I'd come back just totally spent.
Well, also, the other change that I had made prior to this. So the first thing that went was the dispatcher.
Right.
And, you know, we used to have, I mean, I can't even count the number of times I was holed up in that, you know, in the boiler room back there with the scanner on and my, you know, train sheet or a booklet of clearance forms and.
That was pre Franken Mike, or was that during that?
No, during that, yeah. The Franken Mike is still back there. It's waiting to be transported to the Museum of Natural Science or
Smithsonian.
Like Smithsonian. So, you know, but that was the first thing to go because Dave, who was, you know, was the dispatcher, and, you know, he came out and ran once and he decided he really enjoyed running. So I said, what are we doing this for? Nobody liked doing the paperwork. You know,
right.
I'm sure people listening to this will probably disagree.
There were clerk's jobs, you know, and
oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if you enjoy 3 hours of, you know, staging the obsession paperwork wise, but, you know, some of that you have to do.
The waybills have to be done. It's as simple as that. But during the session, to be writing out clearance forms all day, for both for the dispatcher and for the crews especially, is it value added? That's the thing you have to ask. You have to ask that question. Is it value added? Are people enjoying doing this? And the answer was universally no. It wasn't,
you know what I would say about that, though? I would say I think the exercise was worth having because
– well, several years worth of doing that. Yeah,
but I think I think everybody – maybe not everybody, but I certainly learned a lot about how things are supposed to be. I had no experience with that, you know.
I didn't either.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, when you've got – like Dave was a professional dispatcher. So,
right.
You know, you know he kind of set a tone about – how things needed to be and how things should be managed. Now we kind of do that automatically because we all know. I don't know if we would have gotten there so completely without that exercise.
Well, I think there's I think we've overshot a little bit. I mean, we eliminated the paperwork and the formal dispatching, and then we use these radios. We have two scanners set up, one under Madrid with a big speaker, one over at New Sharon with a big speaker, and everybody has radios. I think we need to get back to Joe and I were talking about this, about having a roaming dispatcher, and that could be me or Joe most times, if not all the time.
Well, that's kind of what Dave does here.
Yeah, but do it formally because, use the radio. Go walk, you know, if you see the dispatcher walking around 2 feet next, you go in the next room. Call him up and say, look for approval. He can give you approval from, you know, give you the clearance from point A to point B without having to fill out a piece of paper. But we're still doing the same process. And I think the radios with the scanners specifically, because you've got these big speakers and you hear that communication, that lends an air of real railroading to the whole thing without it being cumbersome. The paperwork part of it, the filling out clearance forms, to me, although it was interesting, it was, I think it got cumbersome after a while, and that's what we eliminated that. So it's
I completely agree, and I think that I don't know if it was you or Joe who said after my last op session that the next thing we need to do here is radios. You know.
Yeah, you need radios.
And
yeah.
I could probably do the same kind of thing with a scanner speaker at Pittston Yard.
Yeah. Yes.
Be a natural for that, and I think the place is big enough now that you kind of need radios.
Oh, I think you do. When I was down in Lacyville there, when I was working that job, the WASY-10, I said to myself, well, if I had a radio now, I can call the dispatcher who's all the way the heck, you know, down in the other building.
Right.
And, you know, get some clearance to get onto the main line. But I couldn't because I didn't have the radio. So adding those will add a nice element of prototypical flavor to the operation. So I'd highly recommend that.
How many radios do you think I need? Like, is half a dozen enough?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I have four here because it came in a set of four. I need to get, I think, one or two more just to have a couple extras. The things eat batteries like crazy. So,
well, I guess when you come right down to it, you need a radio for every simultaneous activity, right? So if you had two locals out, they need a radio. If you've got Mahoopany, they need a radio. That's three. Pittston Yard, of course, needs a radio. That's four. Right. And all of that is probably – and then you need something for a road train needs a radio. So that's why I was thinking half dozen probably would be the magic number. But if they come in packs of four – you probably want 2-4 packs
because these
things are little pieces of junk at any given really time. Are. One of them's down, right?
Yeah, I would get 2-4 packs, and they work really well. And you just keep a couple of extras on hand. But they, I think, like you said, you need your yards to have them, your dispatcher, and your whatever crews happen to be out there working on working a job.
Do you think the scanner speaker at the yard is absolutely necessary, or if you had a radio with a shoulder thing, you might not need that?
My opinion on that is that I think the scanner and speaker adds a very a nice flavor. I mean, because it's loud. That's
adds
the bottom
to the
line.
Ambience. I see
it's got the ambience. Yeah. Yeah, it's like when you're inside a yard office or a tower or whatever, you're going to hear that that transmission. It's going to be loud. So I think that just kind of ramps up the drama a little bit, and it's kind of cool, I have a couple of cheap scanners. One of them I used to rail fan with, and I've got one of those. And I don't think you need it, but I've got one of those big antennas too, so it's under Madrid, and it the reception's great. So when that thing sparkles, man, when you hear that thing crack, if someone's calling, it really cracks. You know, it's not just this little; it just blares out. And
right.
Kind of neat. So,
do you think? I was thinking that if I can find an affordable little walkie-talkie that has. That sort of police type shoulder mounted thing that you can kind of just talk into. So you can interact with the thing a little bit more easily. Do you think that's worth looking into, or do you think it's overkill?
No, I think it is, because we talked about that here 3 years ago. I said, I'm going to get these shoulder mount things, and I never did.
Well, I didn't know if that was at the time something that, because of the paperwork aspect, we thought that would be useful, and that now that we're not doing that sort of radio dictated paperwork, maybe it's not needed. I was just wondering what you thought about that.
It's a good point, but if it's still, I think it would still be worth it, only because then where the radio is. Otherwise, is it in my pocket? Did I put it down somewhere? And you're carrying the thing around, and that can get cumbersome. So I think it's still worth looking into, even though you don't really. Your hands are generally, you got a throttle, you got a swizzle stick that you're uncoupling with. So I think it would still be pretty convenient to have over the shoulder. And then you just, talk into it. I think it's something to look into for sure.
I don't know if they do that for the class of little handhelds that we use, but I'm gonna look at that. I'd actually bookmarked some things in Amazon, that made it easy for me to get back to it, and I may try to incorporate that for the December op session. We'll have to see.
I would get on that, you know. Yeah, Ace Hardware has them. I mean, the radios, I got it through Ace. Now, I could swear the older radios I had, the last set, the little blue ones, I'm pretty sure it was a shoulder harness accessory that you could buy for that. So it might be worth looking into. And I'm going to do the same here because I think it would be kind of cool, actually, to have those.
Well, just to finish up on the op session, you know, for me, as you know, it's very different hosting an op session from attending an op session, right?
Right.
And after 10 months of work, you know, you're testing the whole thing out and it seems to work just fine. And you never really know for sure until you get a bunch of people that don't know necessarily every nuance that you know mm-hmm. using the system and you see what happens. I was particularly interested to see how people would interact with the swing gate, you know, which is kind of the linchpin of everything there, you know. And if that concept had crashed and burned, that would have been a serious setback because I did not have a plan B. I really put all my eggs in that very expensive over-engineered basket, you know. So yeah, it was gratifying to see that it basically worked just fine.
Yeah,
it was also really interesting to see how the extended runs really, for me, added to the sense of length to the whole thing. You know what I mean? I wasn't getting places too quickly. It really felt for me like I was actually going somewhere, and having the people more physically separated for the first time was also kind of cool because, you know, when everybody's, I mean, inevitably we run into a situation where everybody's standing there at Madrid and we had our everybody standing at Pittston Yard moments too, you know, but you could also go off and do things, you know. Jim Reddington's working Mahoopany and he doesn't have all the bustling activity of Pittston Yard right behind him. That's a big change.
It's a big change, and it's not something you necessarily want to – I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there, the majority of people don't have the luxury of having a large railroad room like we do, you know.
Right.
So they're you basically – you have to make do with what you have, right?
But you know what? No matter what size your railroad is, if you're not paying attention to how people are going to move while operating it,
right,
you're making a mistake, you know. And I think I learned a lot of that, you know. I mean, I've always maintained you look at your room, you try to design the benchwork and the aisles intelligently, and then you look at that proposed footprint and you try to figure out how you're going to make a proper model railroad in that footprint, because there's not usually a lot of choice in your benchwork footprint if you're taking into consideration how do I get into this layout room, how many duck unders, if any, do I want to live with, you know. How old is my operating crew, and you know, how does the aging of it affect the enjoyment of it, you know, things like that. If you're not taking that into you know, if you're building your model railroad when you're, you know, 40, that's not even on your radar, you know. But
that's right.
Now that I'm in my 60s, yeah, I was thinking about that.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we have the same. Just to get back to your question, your observation about the additional space and people are spread out more. That's very true. Very cool. You know, having the ability to spread people out, and it doesn't necessarily mean you add more people. You take the existing sweet spot, which is in the, say, seven guys, five to seven number, maybe. That's the
agreed. We had five for this test session, and yeah. I think seven is my perceived max.
Now, we know about some large railroads, I won't again mention names, and that are, you know, big layouts just like yours and mine, and the number of operators, you know, you hear it takes 18 or 20 guys to run, you know, to have an op session. And I can't even imagine the amount of noise that would generate. I've just found that, and I remember years ago in the early Allagash days, we had a couple of op sessions where I had like a dozen people here. I think it was like 12.
Right.
And I remember saying to myself, I will never do that again. Never.
Right. I
never
had one happened. Big one here too, and it's like herding cats because it's too many people's agendas and jobs to manage. You know, when people aren't doing anything, they're taking up space and they're not adding to the session. So you become a slave to trying to keep these people all doing something. And it's, you know, it's not easy to do that, particularly when everything is so sort of interrelated. So I'm, you know, people say, well, you know, how many people are you going to need to run your layout now? And I say, no change.
Same. Yeah.
No change.
Well, it depends. Some guys, and this is, again, this is just to each his own. Some guys, all of the different jobs, every job is filled, right? So you need, if you want to do that prototypically, you need to fill, you know, the clerk jobs and all these different jobs, especially back in the day where there were a lot more functions, right?
Right.
In our case, I think what we, at least in my case, I speak for myself. I don't really, when I come up with a plan for the Allagash, I don't come up with, say, how many guys do I need or how is this going to look? I prefer to do it by feel. So in other words, if I'm a guy standing trackside, what does it feel like? If I'm watching the action, what do I see? I've got my scanner, I'm hanging out in my car in 1985 and I'm watching the action. I see a couple guys on a crew, they're switching. I hear some communications over the scanner. I see a road train. I see a local. That's about it. That's all I see. So I want to represent that. How do I represent that on the model railroad? And how many guys do I need to do that? Now, if I want all these back, these jobs in the background, in the periphery that are there, but I'm not aware of, then it takes more people to do that. And by doing so, then you add a lot of bodies, you add noise, you add,
right,
harder to control as a layout owner, as the operator, as the person who's organizing this. And, you
people,
know,
people standing around doing nothing, interfere with the people who are actually doing something.
Well, I was going to say they may be doing nothing or they may be doing functions that are not germane to the kind of basics of watching trains in action. I think it depends on what you want out of it at the end of it. There's no right or wrong. It's just, I think from experience, you know, we put so much emphasis on the sound experience and it's come such a long way. It's when you have a lot of people at a session, it's hard to hear, you know, what your locomotive, it's hard to hear.
Yeah. You don't want to hear people jabbering constantly. Exactly.
Right. And you know how I am. I don't tell, you know, hey, if I see people hanging out at Madrid and there's a lot of BSing going on, I go over there and what do I say? I say, get out of here.
I've been kicked out of there numerous times.
Yeah. You know, yap. Like I've said to you, I'm in the zone. If I'm working a train during a session, I said, I'm in the zone. I don't feel like talking about if the Red Sox won or if the Patriots are going to win on Sunday. I just want to run my train.
Right.
And, you know, we can talk over at lunch. So,
I think your interest or characteristic being that way has actually grown over time. Like, I think you're even more so now.
Well, because I'm not locked in a closet dispatching trains. I'm not running around like a chicken with my head cut off, asking every person, how are you doing over here? How are you doing? Because back in the day when there were, when we were running a full schedule and we had a few extra guys and things were more chaotic and people weren't as experienced. So I had to wear a lot of hats. Now I'm just one of the guys, you know how it is. We show up.
You've got a working system up there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody knows what they're supposed to do. And actually I think those same guys down here know exactly what to do down here. And that, management standpoint, that helps a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, this past op session, I ran a mainline train, maybe for the first time, you know, in my own op session.
Wow.
And I also ran at least one local job. And but still managed to spend time observing the crews doing their thing in all cases, which is something else I wanted to be able to do. I wanted to make sure that, you know, the initial concept of how people would move from place to place and follow their train and all that, you know, it gratified me to see it. Yep, it's working as designed, and there's no problem that has cropped up here that I didn't know I was going to have, you know. So big relief, really, for me that it just kind of went like it did.
And eventually you'll get to a point, and I'm at the point now, but eventually you'll get there where your mindset won't be coming from a test perspective. I got to see how this works. I got to see how,
you know, I may be there, you know, now.
Yeah, maybe you're there now.
Because you know, the rest of the layout just worked just fine. And yeah, the test aspect of it was all the new trackage, and in particular the gate. You know, I wanted to make sure that worked as designed. And now, for my purposes, I think the concept has been vetted, and I think the next op session will be pretty much a normal op session, hopefully.
Yeah, and I thought this one was normal too. There was nothing out of the ordinary. It was
way more normal than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a good thing. You know, I think you'll find one of the most gratifying things, I'm sure you would agree, is to actually run a train on your own railroad during an op session.
Yeah,
and you know,
you need
what
to
I've
do
been,
more of that.
Yeah, and I've been. We didn't finish up, you know, the whole schedule the last couple sessions. So I was just down there. Not last night, the night before. And, of course, we're at the end of our second session, the second half of the session. It goes to night operation. So I know we didn't do that as a group this last time, but I've been downstairs in the dark, three or four times since the last session.
Well, you had to finish my Carthage turn there.
That thing is still, it's at Weld now. I made it to Weld. And it's I was waiting for a road train to come through, which went through. So I got to run that into Madrid. I've been in Madrid, you know, for 2 hours at a clip in the dark, switch drilling cars. And it's been
great.
That
must be very relaxing, you know.
It's fantastic.
And it's funny, after my last op session last week, everybody had departed, and I went up and, you know, ate a little something. I went back downstairs and channeled my inner Confalone and turned down a lot of the lights.
Turned down.
I mean, I don't have the ability to do it like you do because you've got some auxiliary lighting and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. But I can see the merit of that to certain extents. And I ended up running the last local that we hadn't run, and ran over to Ransom and switched out the paper mill there and ran back to Pittston. And I enjoyed that too, you know what I mean? So I think that the idea of doing some things in between also has a lot of merit. So I know I think I was telling you on one of our calls that the day after the op session, I finally had the luxury, because now the layout's running again. Everything's, all the connective tissue is in and working, and the layout is operational. And I see nothing planned that will result in any kind of significant time outage to the layout being operable. Anything I want to do can fit in a gap between op sessions. So I went down there, and I thought, wow, I can do whatever I want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
What do I want to do? And I probably spent over 2 hours just kind of walking around and looking at things and saying, yeah, I could do that. And that would, because anything I want to do now is going to be fun. Like and not that anything hasn't been. I mean, I've thoroughly enjoyed this entire process. But as I started to look at other things that I wanted to do, I was also thinking, you know, what would be the biggest value add between now and the next op session, you know? And I think I quickly concluded that extending the DNH into north staging would be both achievable and well worth it. And then as part of that, I thought I should probably try to make a decision finally on the Taylor Yard situation and all of that, which then ties into the Taylor secondary and all the stuff going on, you know, over near Kerr McGee. So some discussions about that we had and that Dave and I had, and basically this afternoon, Dave and I are going back to the lumberyard, man. We're hitting it hard this afternoon.
Wow. You guys have been hitting it hard for a long, long time. And, you know, it shows in the results. And
he retired from the railroad at just the right time for me. Really appreciate the convenience of that. You know, having Dave on tap has been critical to this piece.
Yeah, well, it's good for him, keeps him involved in the process and helps you out at the same time, and it's a win-win, right? From both a planning point of view and the actual physical work, it's all good. So
I've got a few hanging chads that look like they're resolving themselves too. Jimmy Booth has basically completed the decals for the P&E GP9, and I'm going to be getting those in from him and sending the unit down to our buddy Bob Harp to do up, hopefully in time for the next session.
Who's Jimmy Booth?
Not Jimmy Booth. Jimmy Abbott. There's too many Jimmys, and I'm going to talk about another Jimmy next. Jimmy Abbott
of Highball Graphics Decals in Ossipee, New Hampshire. Yes,
Jimmy Booth was from another model railroad company. Wow. Eel River, I think, among other things. PBL. And Jimmy Simmons got back to me today and said he's not going to be able to do the ransom work. He just doesn't have enough materials, and his new job has just got him saturated. So I got to go with plan like D on ransom.
After all that time, you know. Can you pretend the paper mill had a really catastrophic fire and burned to the ground?
Don't think so. I've got everything to build it except the wall. So I'm just going to have to get manly with it and get my mind right and cut 88 perfectly aligned windows, you know?
Holy cow.
But Russ Green got back to me, New England Brownstone, and he's finally successfully cast the piers for Pittston Junction. I already had the abutments and retaining walls that he had done for me a long time ago. So
The
piers were kind of the limiting factor. Not that I'm going to jump right on that, but it'd be nice to have all of that for when I feel like doing it this winter.
Sure. And there'll be plenty of time to do plenty of projects. So, and you'll also get back to the spray booth. You've got installs. You got all kinds of stuff.
Like I said, there's a reason.
There's a reason I call you the world's most interesting man.
Well, you're fairly interesting yourself. What do you have in the way of projects that you're doing? I know you've become a major video producer, but you know what's going on in Confalone world?
A major video producer. Wow. So there's a couple of after a fairly lengthy period of being inactive. I've done a lot of work, as most of the listeners know, for Model Railroad Hobbyist over the years. I started back in 2011, 2012. Got a bunch of scenery DVDs, weathering, a lot of articles, ops, you know, videos, just a lot of content. And I also understand that if
anybody's interested in owning a piece of the Allagash, just get on eBay. You're always on there selling stuff, right?
I'll get to that in just a quick, well, I'll just make mention. I do, I weather freight cars, and I have three or four on there every Sunday night, just search under Allagash Railway. And there'll be some Allagash stuff, but mainly just generic, you know, run of the mill, everyday freight cars and locomotives and things like that. But there's a couple of new projects for Model Railroad Hobbyist. Last year I did a video called Allagash Up Close and Personal. And that was volume one. And essentially, it's a one-to-one video tour, an operations video. But it's I operate the camera, operate the throttle, and talk into a lavalier mic all at the same time. So as you can, it's very not easy to do. It's challenging.
Like someone is rail fanning your railroad, basically?
No. It's this particular one. So it's there are two different things. This up close and personal thing. Which volume two comes out next month, by the way. It's essentially an ops tutorial. It's me taking a particular job. Last year it was the White Mountain Switcher. This year it was the Carthage Turn. And running that job from start to finish, and every move that I make during that job is documented on film. And I'm sort of narrating the process as we go through. It's pretty cool.
So new hires on the Allagash would have to view this as part of their onboarding.
Yes, that's right. They're onboarding and they're training. So that's Up Close and Personal. And volume two comes out in November. And look for ads in Model Railroad Hobbyist and at the Model Railroad Hobbyist store. The other project is a little different. It's outside the box. It's called Allagash Trackside Action. And what that is a video documentary of the railroad through the eyes of a rail fan. And that is done with a GoPro camera and professional narration and professional sound. Volume one of that is on Trainmasters TV now and is also available as a download through the Model Railroad Hobbyist store. Volumes two and three, so it's a trilogy for season one. It's sort of a mini series. Season one, episodes two and three come out, I think, in December and January or November. I forget. Anyway, the next couple of months, those are forthcoming. Watch your local listings. That is really never been done before. You've seen the video. We've watched the first one here. It's
It looks good.
It's pretty killer. Yeah, it's like nothing I've ever done before.
Well, just that little quickie video that you did here when you came down one time got just rave reviews.
Well, the GoPro camera does a nice job of it's got a tremendous depth of field, and you can put it in places where you can't put an ordinary camera.
We're just scratching the surface on that thing, I think.
Just scratching the surface. And a lot of what I've been doing, though, is creative lighting.
Right.
And that's important to try and create real atmospheric conditions. So it's really, you know, I've made every effort in doing these videos to not show anything that would indicate this is in a model on a model railroad. Like the ceiling is cropped out.
Right.
You know, wall seams. I've gone to great lengths to make it look like it's real, and it's pretty darn close. So take a look at that if anybody's interested. And you know, there'll be plenty of advertising coming on that. Other than that, it's really just, you know, enjoying the op sessions. And then this winter I've got the Martin Spur, which is really one of like three areas that haven't been sceniced. And that is probably next up. We've got the Oxford County short line, which is a whole other story. That was a new short line that was created a while back, but it's really taken on a life of its own, as you know. And it's been a lot of fun sort of creating that little proto-freelanced operation within the Allagash thing. So that continues to evolve.
I think the Oxford County has consumed a lot of paint.
Yeah, a lot of orange paint. Many different shades of orange paint.
Right.
Yeah, it's been fun. There's some locomotive projects. I've got a few things on the workbench that I'm working on. You know, I've got a GP39-2 Delaware and Hudson that I'm weathering, and I repainted the gray on it because I'm not satisfied with the factory gray. It's got to be the right gray, yada, yada, yada. So stuff like that, just little bits and pieces. Nothing major, no destruction or anything, but I would say that the Martin Spur, which is the operated by the Oxford County, is that industrial park that has a lot of very cool industries. It's been sitting there on plywood for a long time now.
Right.
About time they get some, it's due for some attention. So that could potentially be a big one during the winter.
On my end, I've got my usual Getting Real column coming up, and I think I have a due date of December for January, or it might be November for December. I'm not sure, but that'll be coming up. And I've got an article that I'm now going to be doing for RMC specifically. They asked for this about the road gate. I didn't want to do the article until it had been vetted in a session, because prior to that, it was all theoretical. So, you know, no shortage
with a name. We need to come up with a name for that gate. And I was going to call it Hellgate.
Negative connotation, though.
The Hellgate Bridge, yeah. I'll think up something. You know how I always come up with quirky names? I'll come up with something.
It deserves a name.
Well, it has a sound. You know, I was down when I was in Lacyville, switching. I heard that thing from all the way down there. I heard someone either go in or out.
Yeah, it's got like a bank vault ka-junk to it.
It wasn't just the ka-junk. It's got a creaking to it a little bit, almost like a cemetery gate in one of those old horror movies.
Oh, yeah, it's a little eerie. That's the spring-loaded wheel, exactly.
Yeah, so it's got a lot of cool sound effects to it, and when you bang that thing, it does make quite a clunk. So it's an impressive piece of engineering, that's for sure.
All right, Mike. Well, I know you're up against it here time-wise, and we've probably prattled on as long as we can for today, but I appreciate your efforts as always, and looking forward to your next op session.
I appreciate yours as well, doing this podcast and all the help you've given me on the many projects we've done here on the Allagash. It wouldn't be possible without your help, and so I appreciate that as well.
There's so much cross-pollinization at this time that I think the horsepower hours are not something we worry about anymore.
Nah, as long as you feed me, I'm good to go. You know how that goes.
Oh, absolutely.
And I do the same here. So.
Mexican Coke.
Yeah, I got to get one. We got to set up a date for that that Diamond Crossing at some point, and I'll make sure I have many Mexican Cokes on hand for you.
There you go.
All right,
folks. Well, we'll see you next month. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.